Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
If it pleases the Court, my name is James Rittinger. I believe I have 15 minutes. I'd like to reserve 5, if that's okay.
Yes, but you'll have to keep track of your own time because that will continue to show the total.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Why don't you just tell us what you think your strongest point is?
I have too many, Your Honor, but I think that you can start from the beginning to the end. So I will go in order, and I'll do it very quickly.
There's five
issues on the appeal, and then there, of course, there is the motivating factor, the way that Gross changed the law. If you want to start at the back, there's a motion pending, which I don't think has been dealt with, where we asked to submit supplemental briefing. But quite frankly, I don't think it's necessary. I think the Court knows what happened in Gross, and let me just say quickly, the opposition to that motion, which was also on the merits, was one, that the instruction that was given was not a motivating factor instruction. I think that is not correct. Let's put it that way. It was the Ninth Circuit instruction that was given. The other argument that was made with respect to that is that we did not ask for a but-for instruction, and we didn't. And I think the law could not have been clearer that the motivating factor was the law. There is some dispute or some debate, I guess, as to whether this Court had held absolutely specifically. But what my opponent does in saying that but for a motivating factor was he cites two cases that were before Price Waterhouse brought in motivating factors. So clearly, since Price Waterhouse, I'm not aware of any instruction. And of course, the Ninth Circuit model instructions were changed a day or two after the Gross decision came down. So that means we have a new trial. We don't want a new trial, Your Honor. We want to go to the beginning. Let's talk about the 120 days.
Did the Gross case come down after the jury was instructed?
Yes, it did. But I don't think there's any question that this – if there's a question in that, I would like to brief it. But I don't think there's any question that the Court has to – we have to go back and have a new trial as a result of Gross. Let's start with the 120 days, which I think is extremely strong.
Let me ask you this. Should the district court make that decision or should we?
Oh, I think you can make that decision.
I know we can.
Well, I think you should make it. I have more – I won't go any further than that.
I heard that coming.
I'm afraid of the decision that I might get, Your Honor, because I haven't gotten many good ones. And the ones that I did get, the rewards that I got the rewards that I got turned out to be sanctions. That's the Cloutier testimony and damages. And I don't think there's any question about that, but I'm going to try to get to the 120 days and I'll move forward with respect to that. On the 120 days, first of all, it was 563 days. That was the time. All right. There's no question about that. And
that was when it was in state court.
It was served in state court. The Lee case says that state law should have been applied. It is true that we argued in the motion both state and federal law, but the district court also considered both state and federal law. The 120 days was the same. The difference between state and federal law was that under Nevada law, you have to show good cause, and if you don't show good cause, you're out. Under federal law, you're supposed to show good cause, but if you don't show good cause, then the court still has the discretion to let it go. But the district court was clearly wrong in what it said, because it gave us the Hobson's choice. You remove, and that gave them a whole new 120 days. I don't know how to... One thing I don't have a problem is talking low, Your Honor.
I was going to say, why don't we turn that off? It'll be better.
Put that away. I'm sorry. So the district court was wrong at what it did. Now let's look and see
May I ask a question? Does that mean we're not recording it?
We are recording.
Okay.
Let's look and see what the plaintiff says was, because clearly there had to be good cause. So what does he say this good cause was? Well, his first good cause was the lawyer who represented the plaintiff at the time did all this because he didn't want to waste resources of the court, and he wanted to wait until the EEOC decision came out of the right to sue letter. Aside from the fact that he could have gone back and asked for the right to sue letter, the problem with that is there's a number of problems with that. First of all, it's not in the record. There's nothing in the record at all. There's a cite to the record where the EEOC proceeding is cited, but nothing about the attorney that was representing Mr. Dillon at the time wanting to preserve resources, and that's why he didn't serve. And even if there was, I'm not sure that's a legitimate reason anyway. But then you have the problem, well, I was preserving my resources until the EEOC letter came down. Well, he served the complaint, I think it was at least 60 days or 150 days after the EEOC letter, 60 days after the right to sue. So here he is supposedly preserving assets so he can get on this case, and he doesn't do it. So there's no good cause. The second thing that they say is, well,
is that issue waived?
I don't believe it's waived at all, Your Honor.
Did the district court ever hear this?
Oh, it's waived by the plaintiff, not by us.
I understand.
No, we had nothing in the record about that. Nothing. Then I can pass quickly on the motion, too. There's another one. And sometimes defending a position of the district court is best exposed by the merits of the arguments against it. The second argument on that is, well, there was a motion made in state court. Well, there was a motion made in state court. That motion was to extend. It wasn't done because the plaintiff's attorney did it on his own. He was told to do it by the district court, and that motion was never acted upon. Now, there's an argument actually in the briefs that the district court here, the federal district court, was ruling on that motion. Well, again, you got a problem. It's not in the record. It was never in the record. So what's the real good cause? The one thing that they all stand on, the statute of limitations is run.
The motion to extend wasn't in the record, or there was no discussion at all about that?
It wasn't in the record. It's not in the record.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reference to it. As a matter of fact, when we removed, there was a certification that both sides signed that there were no motions pending. So, I mean, again, here you have it.
So let's get past that, and let's go to the next issue. Well, as I read the Nevada rule, it says, if the party on whose behalf such service was required fails to file the motion to enlarge the time for service, the court shall take that failure into consideration in determining good cause. So as I understand it, then that's one thing that would maybe go in your favor. But as I understand it as well, we still have to apply all of the tests of Scrivener versus the Eighth Judicial Circuit.
Yes, Your Honor. And I guess what I would say there is, other than the fact that the statute of limitations is wrong, and there's none of those factors favor them. And the statute of limitations has run, and I don't think this. You can search far and wide. There are cases where obviously where discretion is exercised and good cause is shown, but not on the time periods that you've got here. I can't find anything that's close to that. And it's not just once; it's twice. They missed it on the 120 days, and then they missed it on the 90 days. The statute of limitations is the result of no good cause. The worst case scenario for us, quite frankly, we mentioned this in the brief, is that I guess it could go back to the district court to see if there was good cause. But then again, I would point out that the district court said at the time that there was no good cause shown, but he didn't feel that he had to. He didn't feel that he had to find it.
Well, did he really say that there was no good cause? I thought he said, there's no excuse for failing to serve the defendants in a timely manner, or the excuse was weak. However, the defendants have not shown that they suffered any real harm by the admittedly untimely service. That's the best I can see that he ever said.
I'll accept that, Your Honor. Maybe I'm saying too much, but there has been prejudice, Your Honor. The prejudice is the length of time. The prejudice is the back pay award. There clearly was prejudice. But if time limits are going to make anything at all, they're going to mean anything, there have to be cases.
You lost the case, but that doesn't count.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You may have lost the case, but I don't think that counts as prejudice from the untimeliness.
Well, Your Honor, just the time period at all, I don't know. If you look what happened with the damages. The damages, they violate
Did you lose any witnesses as a result of the untimeliness, or did?
Well, I would say we probably lost Rose Titus, but that's not part of this appeal.
Okay.
Yeah, between the time that your deposition was taken and the time of trial, we lost her. But if I can, if the Court has any questions, I'm running quickly out of time. I'd like to get the Cloutier. If the Court has any questions about the Cloutier, I would say this, that that is clearly a situation where the door was opened by the plaintiff's questioning. Then in the district court at the time that he let him come on said it was because of that. Now, when we went back to the post-trial briefing, the district court said, you know, he got the point, well, wait a minute, the door could not have been opened by plaintiff. That's not fair. But you opened the door yourself by putting on a defense. Well, I can tell you, Your Honors, that I guess the irony of this thing is the order came down on a motion for summary judgment where the district courts where we said he never disclosed who he was. So he said, well, you can't use his affidavit. I'm not going to consider it. But you lose the motion for summary judgment. Plaintiff scrambled time and time again to try to get that order taken out. Then, when we get to trial,
is our standard review on that particular matter?
Your Honor, I think that was probably an abuse of discretion, but I do believe that the discretion has been abused.
If you went on that point, is that a...
If there's any questions on that, I'd like to get to the criminal conviction.
Let me ask one question. If you went on that issue, is that just a remand?
I believe it is, Your Honor. Yes, I believe that the only way that we cannot... we haven't talked about sufficiency of evidence. I think in order to have this case finally over, and I think it should be, Your Honors, it really is on the lack of service. It would not be on either that or the Cloutier testimony or obviously the damages. Let me quickly talk about the conviction. That is again abuse of discretion, but there's also the incorrect application of the law. The district court made a factual finding, and that factual finding was that the probative value of the felony conviction was enormous.
Well, that isn't exactly what he said.
Substantially.
Well, Your Honor, I hope I haven't hyperbolized that. I do believe...
I think you have. He said
substantially.
Without the word substantially plugged in there, I think it may well be admissible. But I don't think that it substantially outweighs the prejudice. That's what he said.
No, but that's when he was balancing that. That's what he said when he was balancing the probative value versus the prejudice. But the probative value, I believe, he did say was enormous, and he said what probative value was. He was correct about that. He said it's trustworthiness.
Well, but again, we're on abuse of discretion here. We really are, and this is a 14-year felony, 14 years from the day of the trial. And we're on an abuse of discretion. I hope we got a better argument on other issues than that. Well, because now I'm a DJ. I got a felony in front of me that was committed 14 years ago, and the statute generally would say I ought not let it in unless I really want to. And I'm going to say because he suggested he wasn't letting it in, it's an abuse of discretion.
Your Honor, I think he got the law wrong and therefore abused his discretion. Probative value means trustworthiness. He said there was enormous, I believe he said enormous, maybe it was substantial probative value. Obviously, if there's enormous probative value, there's going to be substantial prejudice. It can't be the same kind of prejudice. It can't just be that because it has high probative value, it's every time the higher the probative value, the more prejudice there's going to be. And that's what happened here. He made no finding as to what prejudice really means.
If you want to save your time for
your
other issues on rebuttal, you better do so.
Before I start, I would know we have a cross appeal. Am I entitled to rebuttal on that? No? Okay. May it please the Court, my name is Randy Rumpf. I represent Larry Dillon. First of all, I want to say that in this trial, it was universally accepted by every witness that Larry Dillon was an excellent salesperson for that company. The defendant so testified, the plaintiff's witness so testified. They stipulated that he was replaced by someone substantially younger, and then there was evidence that the reason given was a bald-faced lie. They claimed that he had forced a client's signature multiple times and that he admitted it, which he denied, which the jury accepted that denial. He was warned by his boss before he was terminated, the company is targeting you for termination because of your age. Mr. Kennedy, his boss, told third parties, I fired him because of his age.
Mr. Rumpf, you're not making the argument to the jury here. I appreciate this is your best argument. I appreciate you got $1 million two times on that. But I think you ought to hit this issue dead on about why you didn't serve.
I was a counsel at the time. But what they did.
You were not?
I was not.
That's good. Given that there stands a malpractice claim on that one.
That may be true. I was not. What they did was the counsel at the time did supply the court with the EEOC documents. And it can clearly be inferred that they were arguing to the court, we've been arguing this before the EEOC. We have been involved in this same issue in an administrative proceeding for over 2 years. That went on for over 2 years. Now, I wouldn't know.
That doesn't matter. That really doesn't matter because they received the notice of letters of rights letter from the EEOC in October 2002. They still didn't do anything until March of 2003.
Approximately 5 months. But
they only had 120 days. So that's not a big argument. Let's go on with something that really gets to the issue.
I would note also that the defendant did admit in the pleadings below that the issues, this is at Plaintiff Supplemental Record 25, he is pursuing long-lost state law claims that are based on the same facts as the dismissed EEOC complaint. So they admitted in the record below, we've been arguing these same issues in front of the EEOC. So are they
prejudiced? That goes to the second issue, really, as to whether we ought to let you amend to add another claim. Let's talk about the motion to dismiss for timely service.
First of all, what the judge said is he said when they removed it, it started a new time period. If you look at the Triple G pizza case, which is, there's only a handful of cases that have really addressed this, and they're district court cases. There's never been a circuit court that's addressed this. And he acknowledged that. Some of those cases disagree with each other. But if you look at the Triple G pizza case, the facts are on all four. There was service of a summons before removal.
Do I have anything in this record that says counsel relied on any of those cases in determining when to serve?
I think the judge did.
I think the judge had to make a ruling. That's not the issue in front of me. I've got a de novo ruling to make. I don't have to go to abuse of discretion here. I've got a de novo ruling. I got nothing in here that says counsel relied on those cases and therefore didn't serve until late. I want to know, given the factors in Nevada law, in Scrivener, or however you say that, versus the 8th Judicial District, what is it we're going to rely on to get you around losing this case?
Well, I pointed out, if you look at Scrivener, the Nevada Supreme Court listed a number of factors that you look at. And they specifically noted in Scrivener, no one factor outweighs the others. And they specifically noted it is within the sound discretion of the district court to make that decision. So,
but the district court didn't make the decision.
I'm sorry?
The district court made no decision about this.
It did note Scrivener. It did, in the order, it did.
Is there ever any order made here?
Yes.
By the district court.
It noted the case. It didn't go into the factors, but it noted the case.
Did it ever enter an order?
Yes.
Where? Where in the record do I find that it entered an order? On this issue.
What he did was he said he went with the starting a new clock with 120 days. That's what the lower court ruled. And my argument, and that's what I said, the Triple G pizza case is right on all fours. They affected service. It was untimely, but they did it before removal. And then the court said, well, you still have it. Once you removed it, you have another 120 days.
But that's what another district judge did in New York, wasn't it?
That's right. And there's not a whole lot of case law on the issue of starting the clock, but that's what this district judge hung his hat on. And my argument in my brief was, a district judge, you can uphold him for any valid reason. And so if you apply Rule 4, you can uphold him. If you apply Scrivener, you can uphold him. But he went with the...
What is my standard of review?
I think it's an abuse of discretion. Again, if you look at...
You think this is an abuse of discretion decision, or is it de novo?
Well, what they argue is it's de novo as to what choice of law you make.
I don't want to know.
The choice of law is de novo, but they waive that. They said apply federal law, Rule 4.
Okay? What is the discretionary decision that we are reviewing?
On the motion to dismiss, the 120 days.
Whether they had the 120 days?
Whether they should be granted an extension, because they didn't serve it within the 120 days, whether they should be granted an extension under Rule 4 of the federal rules or Rule 4 of the Nevada rules, that is the discretion. That's what the Nevada Supreme Court said in Scrimer. It's a discretion as to whether you grant an extension of the 120 days and grant additional time to serve. So if you take out the Triple G pizza and the starting the clock, which is what he did, he didn't address the others, but you can. You can uphold him based on anything that's in the record. But
doesn't the judge under Nevada state law have to find sufficient cause to extend?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't the judge, the district judge, under applying Nevada state law, he has to make a finding of sufficient basis for extending it?
Well, he said there was evidence shown, but it was weak. Did he go into the Scrimer factors? No, because he jumped over to the start the clock over, which is the Triple G pizza issue. So he said, well, I don't have to get into that. There was a showing. It was weak. But in the record, you may uphold it if there's anything in the record.
But he has an obligation to make a finding of sufficient basis, does he not? I mean, not as to whether he did or didn't, but there is an obligation under the law.
If he addressed it, yes, but he didn't. He went with the Triple G pizza issue. Mm-hmm. But there are sufficient facts in the record to show that under Scrimer, under Rule 4, this court, there is a huge, vast body of case law under Rule 4 of the federal rules, the Supreme Court rules, Ninth Circuit rules that we stated, that say you don't even have to make a showing. If there's an ultimate backstop, if you will, that this court has, as a court of equity, to allow an extension of the 120 days and grant a plaintiff additional time to serve. And that's what I argue. You can still apply that rule and that ultimate backstop to this order, because even though he didn't.
Well, were those presented to him?
Yes. The Mann case, I believe, was addressed. Burdett is what prior counsel did submit to him. So, honestly, he didn't address this because he went to that restarting the clock issue. But he did say there was a showing, although it was weak. And they did do that.
Okay, then maybe you better go to some of the other issues.
Okay. The other issue that we appealed was the willfulness issue. And EEOC versus Papliff was this court's decision in 1997, and that case is on all fours here. In that case, you had a store manager who made age comments about the plaintiff, and he lied about why he fired the plaintiff. You had an HR manager that did not make age comments, but also gave a pretextual reason. And this court said the pretext given by the store manager and the HR manager was sufficient to support a willfulness finding. Here we have Mr. Kennedy making age comments, my client's immediate supervisor. I think he alone is sufficient to bind the company, but he set forth a false reason, forging a document. That false reason was repeated by his boss, Mr. Bissig, who was a regional manager over 18 states. It was repeated by Mr. Bissig's boss, Tom Krebs, who was a vice president. So we have not only my client's immediate supervisor, but all the way up the corporate ladder to the vice president saying, you forged a document and you admitted it, which was a bald-faced lie. If you take this court's decision in Papliff and apply it there, I don't know why it doesn't apply. They said, well, we didn't show that Kennedy had sufficient knowledge. This court in Papliff and in Pasatino, under the punitive damage standard, which is about the same for willfulness, said if you give a pretextual reason, that's sufficient for a finding of punitives. That's what this court held in Papliff. It's sufficient.
You want a new trial?
I'm sorry?
You want a new trial?
No.
Well, then why are you arguing so hard on this? Seems to me that this is just an issue that would be of any interest if we send this back for a new trial. Otherwise, the trial's over. Why appeal it? If you're satisfied with what we got, why are you making such a big deal of this?
Because the jury found a willfulness.
I understand, but what are you going to get out of it?
Well, you get a doubling of the back pay.
Okay. And that's all you want is that doubling on remand?
Right. That's our issue on the willfulness. On the issue of on the issue of Cloutier, that was the court's discretion. I've covered that in our brief. On the issue of the jury instructions, the one thing that he didn't tell you is that there were additional instructions. There was the phrase motivating factor, those two words were in the instructions, but they went undefined. The judge never defined for the jury what motivating factor is. He did put instructions in that were compliant with Gross. For instance, he told the jury you had to find that they terminated Mr. Dillon on the basis of his age. The Supreme Court cases
say... Let me ask you this question. If I find the jury instructions do not give the jury the Gross holding and the Gross jury instructions and his instructions do not do it, what is my only thing I can do?
No, under Chancellor, you can look and see if their defendant's rights were substantially harmed. And in that case, they said, if the evidence is weak for age discrimination, you can get a new trial. Certainly implying, if you have strong evidence, you don't get a new trial. If here we have direct evidence of age discrimination and age bias, this is not a weak case. This is a direct evidence case. And in Chancellor, you can still hold in favor of the plaintiff, even if you find that they were non-compliant with Gross. I believe it was either Kelly or Chancellor that said that. So you can still rule for the plaintiff on
that. So that, what case should I really look at?
I believe it's Chancellor. It's a Ninth Circuit case.
You're relying on?
That's what it, well, again, they requested briefing on this topic. I opposed that by saying...
Yeah, I thought you opposed it.
I didn't go into the Chancellor issue because I thought we might rebrief it. I said I don't even think we get to the issue of briefing because the court, their instructions were proper. He said you have to find that my client was terminated because of his age.
So if I don't agree with you on that these instructions met the Gross, you want to brief it?
Well, I would like to...
When was this raised?
When was what raised?
The issue.
The issue was raised by the defendant after their initial brief because that's when Gross came down, after we started briefing.
The case was decided, but wasn't it pending before that?
Gross was pending, yes. Is that your question?
Yes.
Gross was pending,
yes. So that they asked that it be briefed, and I said, I don't think we even get to briefing because he gave Gross compliant... he said...
Weren't they in as good a position as the Gross people to object to the instruction at trial?
I also added that to my opposition to their motion to brief that issue. I agree. They were in a good position. That's been this, you know, there are older Ninth Circuit cases. There's even a 2003
case. How do I deal with Harper versus Virginia Department of Taxation, the 509 U.S. 86, 1993 United States Supreme Court case that says, in a civil case, if we change the law, you apply it retroactively?
I agree, but
it doesn't matter who subjects to what or who doesn't. If you don't do it and it's still on appeal, we apply it retroactively. And if Gross has not been done and not been done correctly, we got a new trial, haven't we?
But my authorities that I showed you, it's a Ninth Circuit case that says you've got to look at all of those instructions as a whole. And as a whole, there was a because of, there was a but for, there were other instructions that were Gross compliant. And the authorities I cited in my opposition said that when you look at them as a whole, you might have a bad instruction, but sandwiched between compliant instructions, it's okay. And that's what I said.
Okay.
That was in my brief.
You're done. Thank you.
First, are there any questions that the court has?
No, I don't.
Well, then I guess I would say just two things quickly. Gross was pending in the Supreme Court, but the decision was a surprise. I think everybody recognized that. On the willfulness issue, just very quickly, the district court followed it correctly. There was no evidence that Mr. Kennedy, who was the person who, you know, made this incredible statement, but the jury believed it, and we're not challenging that today. And that was the sum and substance of that evidence. But there was no evidence that he knew of the AIDS Discrimination Act. And that's what the Thurston case and Hazen paper say you have to have. The district court got that right. On their motion, they do two things. First of all, they say that all evidence that's favorable to the moving party has to be ignored. That's not the law. I think the law is that you consider the evidence as a whole. You can't draw inferences and things like that. And then they do something that they've never done before, and they argue for the first time that Kennedy was the sole decision maker. He never argued that. Even in his main brief, you will notice that that's not argued.
Who was the decision maker?
The decision maker went from, it was the started as high as the legal department. It was the personnel department, and then it was the supervisor, the next supervisor, and then Kennedy. All five people were involved in that decision.
Judge Schroeder, if I could, maybe Mr. Rumpf, Mr. Redinger, have you tried to settle this case?
Your Honor,
have you used our good services of settlement conference? Have you even tried?
Your Honor, I'm going from here to Roseanne Ash afterwards on another case. The problem with settling this case.
Well, now, I don't want to know your trouble. All I'm trying to say is this: if I were faced
with another trial.
And I were faced with losing my case altogether for failing to have served it. And I were faced with the opportunity now to settle this. With this running in the circuit court, I think I would try to settle this case.
Your Honor, there's a
problem. I don't want you to tell me all your problems.
Well, no.
I want you to think about this.
Well, Your Honor, we thought about it. But there's a, Your Honor alluded to it in the beginning of the argument with Mr. Rumpf. There is another potential defendant sitting out there. And that makes it impossible for us to get to a number that makes sense. That's the bottom line.
I'm just trying to... To give you some Idaho talk.
I hear you, Judge.
I asked for that with the services of the Ninth Circuit, and
according to our records, there was a telephone conference call,
and then
it was determined that it was not going to be put into the program, but we don't know why or what happened or anything.
I mean, I think this was a pretty dang good case in Idaho. If I were sitting on the district bench, y'all would be in the settlement conference whether you liked it or not. Thank you.
Do I understand that you do not wish the case? The court would be happy to withhold submission of the case pending pursuit of settlement if you wish to do that. If you are convinced that there's no possibility, we won't do that. Then you're faced with the alternatives that you've just...
I would like to.
Okay. What?
Well, we could certainly talk, Your Honor. I'm not. Should we hold off and just notify the court?
We won't order the case submitted at this time. We'll issue an order.